As you know, I'm dealing with crises and depressions, and there are several very good reasons why we should take an interest in these happenings. One is that we need to be able to expose the silly claims of the Tories and the Labour Party that they know how to abolish them. They can't and they won't. Another reason is that some of the wrong theories about crises and depressions have been used to build up theories about the way capitalism will collapse and socialism will arrive out of the ruins, and it's necessary to know where they have gone wrong and what the real explanation of crises and depression is. The subject itself is a bit complicated, but most of the complication arises out of the fog of unsound theories that have been built up around it. In other words, you've got to clear them away before you can usefully deal with what is actually going on. Marx covered a lot of the ground, and most of his conclusions have been confirmed by later events, but there are a few developments in capitalism since Marx's day that have made some not very important differences that are worth noticing, even if they are not very important in themselves. One other thing to remember is that each crisis and depression has to be looked at in relation to its own circumstances. They, so to speak, they don't follow a coast pattern. You can't say that every one that comes along is just like all the ones that preceded it. If you want to see what confusion there is among economists and politicians, all you have to do is to look at their explanation of the present depression. You'll find that one lot say that the causes are entirely monetary, but even that lot can't agree among themselves, because half of them say that what they choose to call the money supply is too great, and the other lot say that what they choose to call the money supply is too small. Others say, of course, that crises and depressions are due to the greed of trade unions, or faults in the taxation system, or the unwillingness or inability of the banks to lend money to industry. All of the modern economists set out with the assumption that there must be somewhere some policy that would enable them to run capitalism without crises and depressions. They've been looking for it for a couple of hundred years, and none of them have found it, and they're still looking. And if that were not so, of course, they would be able to agree among themselves about the whole subject. None of them recognise, as did Marx, that the cycle of booms and depressions is simply the way capitalism operates, and that there is no remedy within capitalism. Before I deal with the real causes of crises and depressions, there is a question of terminology to be looked at. You've got to remember that the term crisis and the term depression means quite different things. It's important because the factors that cause a crisis are quite different from the factors that operate after the crisis and when the depression actually begins. In several passages in Marx's Capital, he described the cycle that capitalism goes through. One of them is in volume 3, page 423 in the Kerr edition. This is how he lists them. The first phase he calls condition of rest. That's when capitalism is in a depression. The next phase is increasing activity of production, when production is expanding again. The third phase is what he called prosperity, when business is booming and unemployment is very low. Then overproduction, then crisis, and after the crisis, the stagnation or depression, like the one in which we are at the present time. By crisis, Marx meant the sudden interruption of a boom. Everything seems to be going well, business is booming, low unemployment, and quite suddenly you get a reversal. That is what Marx meant by the crisis. And he meant by stagnation and depression the period, short or long, that follows after the crisis, and as I say, you have to keep the two separate. So you've really got three distinct questions to consider. What causes a crisis? What causes a depression? And, of course, the other question, what causes a depression to give way to expansion again? I'm now going to deal with some of the erroneous theories, and remember that at this stage I'm dealing simply with theories about the cause of crisis. Well, one of the erroneous theories is that a crisis is caused because the workers can't buy back the whole output of industry. Now, it is, of course, a fact that the workers can't buy back the whole output of industry. But if you start using this as an explanation of a crisis, you immediately get into a dilemma. The workers never can buy back the whole output of industry. Wages and salaries never are enough to buy everything that is produced. So if their theory is correct, that crises are caused by workers not being able to buy back, crises wouldn't happen, as Marx said, about every 10 years or something like that. They would happen every week and every day. You would have continuous crises. You would, in fact, have a permanent crisis or permanent depression, according to whichever way you look at it. Now, Marx, of course, said that no crisis lasts forever, and Marx was correct. So if you're going to use this argument that crisis takes place because the workers can't buy back, as the workers never can buy back, crisis would be continuous. And the people who hold that erroneous view have made two other assumptions to get themselves out of the dilemma. One of their assumptions is that during the period of expansion and boom, there is every week a quantity of commodities that are produced and cannot be sold. And then they say these things pile up in factories and warehouses and shops until they get so huge they can't be carried any longer, and then a crisis occurs. But in fact, unsold stocks do not pile up in the period of expansion and boom. In the boom, it's the seller's market, and it's in that time that stocks run down because everything that's produced can be got rid of. So that assumption won't work. Their second assumption is that the workers can't buy back the whole output of industry, and the capitalists solve the problem by selling these things abroad. In other words, they put it in this form, the workers' wages and salaries will only buy back a certain amount of the product of industry, and the amount of the product of industry represented by surplus value can't be sold at home, so the capitalists sell it abroad. Now, this is, of course, a self-evident absurdity. According to this theory, unsold goods are piling up not only in this country, but in every other country. If unsold surpluses are piling up in every country because the workers can't buy back, how on earth can the goods produced in one country be sold in another country? If British goods can't be sold in Britain, and German, French and American goods can't be sold in Germany, France and America, how can the workers in all of those countries buy imports from the other countries? Take this country, for example. In 1978, British exports totaled £37,000. But British imports totaled £41,000. Well, if the British capitalists had to export £37,000 because the British workers couldn't afford to buy it, who are the people who buy the £41,000 of imports? I mean, obviously, the thing just does not make sense. The final simple answer is that the imports of one country are the exports of another country. And if you look at capitalism as a whole, imports and exports are exactly the same thing. You're looking at the same thing from a different angle. In other words, there is no gap, and there is therefore no, so to speak, hole in which the capitalists can get rid of the goods that the working class can't buy in their particular country. In fact, the fact that some British industries export to Germany and some German industries export to Britain is no different from the fact that some London manufacturers also sell in Glasgow, and some Glasgow manufacturers also sell in London. Well, I've never heard anybody suggest that the London manufacturers have to sell their goods in Glasgow because the British workers lack purchasing power, and the Glasgow manufacturers have to sell some of their goods in London because the Glasgow workers lack purchasing power. As I say, it just doesn't make sense. Actually, this erroneous idea that crises occur because the workers can't buy back the whole product of industry was known to Marx. It was put to him, and Marx gave his answer, and of course he showed the complete fallacy of it. If you look at volume 2 of Capital, which is pages 4, 7, 5 and 6 in the co-edition, Marx pointed out that what in effect the people who hold this erroneous theory were saying, and I quote from Marx, they're saying that the evil would be remedied by giving the workers a larger share or raising their wages, which is, of course, what they do say. If you say the workers' purchasing power is too small and that causes the crisis, the obvious remedy would be to give them higher wages. And Marx answered this by pointing out that in the period of expansion and boom, workers do always get higher wages and do always get a larger share. I quote, "Wages rise generally, and the working class actually get a larger share of the annual product intended for consumption." So that, as Marx said, if it was really true that crises happen because the workers' wages are too low, and if, therefore, putting up wages would prevent the crisis, crises ought never to happen, because in every boom, wages do rise, and the workers do get a larger share of the goods produced for consumption. And what Marx said then is true now. If you look at the boom in 1971, 2, 3, you'll find that, I said 71 to 3, it's 72 to 75, wages and salaries increased from 83% of total consumers' expenditure in 1972 to 93% in 1975. Then it fell again. In other words, what Marx said in his day is still true. But in a boom, wages rise and the workers get a larger share, and therefore, if this theorem is correct, the crisis ought not to happen. To get the whole thing into perspective, you have to recognise that while some products of industry are produced to be sold to the working class and are bought by the working class, some other products of industry are not produced to be sold to the workers, but are produced to be sold to the capitalists among themselves. Workers don't buy raw materials, they don't buy railway engines and aeroplanes and machinery and factories and things like these. These things have to be bought among the capitalists themselves. And some, of course, of the consumer goods are produced as luxury goods and other goods for capitalists. So you've got the capitalists buying all the producer goods, the machinery and things like this, and also the capitalists buying some of the consumer goods. So what has to be explained is why a boom suddenly turns into a crisis, and I'll come back to that again later. Now, I've dealt with one can't-buy-back theory. That is that the workers don't earn enough wages and salaries to buy the whole product of industry. But there is another can't-buy-back theory. It was started by John Gray in 1848, and it was carried on by Major Douglas, who founded the social credit movement in the 1930s. John Gray put it that in capitalism there is, and I quote, "an underproduction of money," by which he meant that the total buying power of society is always insufficient to buy all the goods produced in society. But while the can't buy back theory I've already dealt with said the workers can't buy back, John Gray and Major Douglas held that the workers and the capitalists together can't buy back the whole product of industry. Major Douglas put his views in various places. If you're interested, you'll find he set it out in a book published in 1931 by Douglas called The Monopoly of Credit. And he wrote, and I quote, "The incomes paid out by industry are not sufficient to buy its own products, meaning that the wages and salaries of the workers plus the rent, interest and profits of the capitalist class, all added together, won't buy the product of industry." In his explanation of his theory, he based it on the supposition that, as he put it, the capitalist buys an article at one price and sells it at a higher price. Now, the first error made by Douglas is, of course, this is simply not true. The cotton spinning company doesn't buy raw cotton at one price and sell it at a higher price. The thing they sell is quite different from the thing they buy. The cotton spinning capitalist buys raw materials and labour power at one price and sells the finished product at a higher price, and the finished product sells at a higher price because it has a greater value than the raw materials and the labour power with which it started. It has a greater value because the workers create surplus value for the capitalists in the form of unpaid labour. Now, it's true that the workers' wages and salaries will not allow them also to buy the equivalent of surplus value, but the capitalist who owns the finished products, including the surplus value in them, then has correspondingly increased buying power, which he exercises in part by buying the kind of commodities, machinery, raw materials and so on, which the workers don't buy. Actually, Douglas provided the answer to his own theory, showed the complete absurdity of it. He said that the result of capitalists buying at one price and selling at a higher price must inevitably produce a situation, and I quote, "in which a small section of the community would own all the money and therefore the remainder of the community would be unable to pay, and production and sale would stop. And that's quite logical. If the capitalist does buy things at a low price and sell them at a high price, all the money will get into the hands of this small section of the community. Nobody else will have any money, nothing will be bought, and therefore production will cease. Well, Douglas wrote this in the Depression of 1931, and he believed that within a very short time this would happen, and that all the workers would be out of work. Of course, it never happened. It didn't happen then, it hasn't happened now, 50 years later. Figures published by the Government Statistical Office are an answer to Douglas on this alleged insufficiency of purchasing power. In 1978, the gross domestic product of this country totaled 141,000 million. Now, according to Douglas, this theory, the buying power of the capitalists and workers together would be quite insufficient to buy 141,000 million of goods and services. But if you look at the other side of the picture, total of wages and salaries in 1978 was 97,000 million, profits were 22,000 million, and the incomes of the self-employed were 24,000 million, and if you add them up, you'll find they not only come to 141,000 million, they come to a slightly larger figure, because there was a certain amount of rundown of stocks. But so far, Douglas is concerned, the whole theory is wrong, that the total buying power of workers and capitalists and the self-employed were equal to the total gross domestic product of this country. Douglas's remedy, as I expect you all remember, was that since there is insufficient money in society, the government must make up the balance by distributing to all the citizens what Douglas called a national dividend. If any government had actually ever done this, all that it would have done, of course, would have been to have produced inflation. I now want to make some preliminary remarks about the idea of overproduction. Overproduction means, of course, producing too much. But you have to ask yourself, too much for what? And the first thing to notice is that capitalism never has and does not now produce enough for the needs of the whole world's population. Marx pointed out in his time that in fact capitalism produced too much for the world's population, it had never produced enough, and it's quite obvious that it doesn't produce enough now. But as Marx went on to say, capitalism isn't interested in the needs of starving people who have no money. Capitalism is only interested in people who have money and are therefore potential buyers. And as a general rule, capitalists do not allow overproduction to take place. That is to say, they try to avoid producing too much for the market to absorb at a profit. As soon as they see this happening in a particular industry, their immediate desire, of course, is to curtail production and see that they don't go on producing things on which they're going to make a loss. There are, however, three exceptions. The first was noted by Marx. He pointed out that there is one kind of necessary and continuous overproduction. Because of earthquakes, storms, floods, fires and crop failures, a lot of commodities that are produced never in fact reach the final buyer. They're destroyed in the process of it. And so, as Marx pointed out, capitalism always has to produce something more than the total demand of the market, and he called this overproduction. That's one of the meanings he attached to it. The second exception is this, that when capitalists have found that they're producing too much for their particular market and therefore are no longer going to make a profit on it, they will sometimes go on producing and storing the unsold goods. I think you've seen it reported in the press at the moment about unsold motor cars. But they only do it in the hope that before very long conditions will change and they'll be able to get back to selling it. And for quite obvious financial reasons, they can't go on doing it for long. Now, the third exception relates to governments. For political and military reasons, governments will buy up commodities and hold them off the market. This includes the strategic reserves of petrol, gold, and various other metals that may be needed in case of war. These are all surplus to the immediate demands of the market. So you do get these three exceptions to what you can take as a general rule, that capitalists try to avoid producing goods surplus to the market's demand because they don't want to sell at a loss. I now come to a simple and plausible explanation of crises based, as the people who hold it would say, on overproduction. Their view is that there is a fixed and maximum total amount of all commodities that the markets can absorb, and that whenever this maximum is reached, there is a crisis. And the people who used it used the analogy of a pint pot. They looked on the increasing expansion of production like liquor being poured into a pint pot. And they say when it reaches the rim, it flows over, and then you have a crisis. Well, it disappeared to make sense, of course, to the followers of John Gray and of Major Douglas. For them, there is a total of commodities that can be produced and sold, because they think there's a shortage of money. So they would say, at the point where expanding production reaches the point where only the capitalists have any money and nobody else has any money, obviously production stops. But in the real world of capitalism, the pint pot theory is wrong for two reasons. The first is the total volume of production and sales in each boom has always been larger than in the previous boom. Or to put it in another way, the pint pot becomes a quart pot and then the gallon pot. It's an irregular movement, but it has gone on for a couple of centuries all through the history of capitalism. British capitalism's total production and sales, for example, at the present time are at least four times as great as they were 100 years ago when Marx was looking at the situation. The second reason why this pint pot theory is erroneous is that it is a mistake to think of capitalists all producing some similar kind of commodity for some huge world market. They are, in fact, producing, each capitalist is producing a particular commodity for a particular market. Some of them are so specialised that, so to speak, there's a very limited amount that can go into that market. Two or three years ago, there were some firms in Scotland organised to build rigs for North Sea oil, and they soon found they'd overproduced them. They then found there wasn't even a chance of selling them anywhere else in the world, apart from the transport difficulties. They were the wrong type. And this is true of capitalism generally, that most capitalists are producing a particular kind of commodity for a particular market. Consumer goods of various kinds for consumer markets, and production goods for particular production goods markets. In the boom which precedes each crisis, you don't have all capitalists suddenly finding that they have all produced enough or too much for their market. In a boom, what you find is some capitalists finding that they have produced too much for their particular market, while at the same time, in a boom, you'll find other capitalists unable to meet the orders they've received because they can't get raw materials and so on. And it's quite obvious that since that is the actual picture of capitalism, the pint pot idea is a fallacy, and it will not explain why crises take place. The next thing to notice about the use of the term crisis is that there are different kinds of upsets, all of them described as crises. One kind are financial, and the others arise out of the conditions of production, and these you can call, as Marx did, industrial or commercial crises. But it is complicated by the fact that when a purely financial crisis arises, it can have repercussions on production. And when an industrial or commercial crisis takes place, it will at some stage have side effects which are financial. You'll notice, by the way, that most modern economists and politicians think that all crises and depressions, incidentally, have monetary causes, like Maynard Keynes, who thought that if credit was properly controlled, there would be no more crises and depression. And like Thatcher and her government at the present time, who think that if only they could control inflation on the monetarist theories of Milton Friedman, they would get rid of depressions and crises and all would go smoothly in future. Financial crises arise out of the very delicate balance of capitalist credit operations. Capitalists sell, but the normal thing is they don't get paid immediately, they only get paid after some lapse of time. And in that lapse of time, the capitalists who have sold and haven't got their money will borrow money from other people to meet their immediate needs and get credit from other capitalists. Now, if you imagine this great chain of debts and borrowing and loans and so on, credit operations, you've only got to get some factor which upsets the confidence of people in the continuation of this system to see that you will be in trouble. You may get a war, or the overthrow of a government, or the bankruptcy of some big bank or commercial concern will destroy confidence and produce a financial crisis. And a financial crisis like that can have some reproduction on production. Now, Marx dealt with the question with having dealt with a number of untenable theories, what precisely is the cause of a crisis? Why do you get this sudden change round of a boom where everything seems to be sailing smoothly and you suddenly find that people have become scared and are afraid that the thing is breaking down? Marx dealt with it by pointing out the fallacy in what is known as Say's Law. J.B. Say, a French economist, coined a phrase which was, every seller brings a buyer to market. What he meant was that if everyone who sells a commodity is then in possession of money and can go and buy something else. If a capitalist sells something for £1,000, he can immediately spend that £1,000 on buying some other commodity. And which leads J.B. Say to think that capitalism is a self-adjusting system. He could see no flaw in this. He assumed that everybody who had sold something and got money would immediately want to buy something else, and that therefore capitalism, except for very, very minor upsets, would be continuously tending towards full production and full employment. What Say overlooked was that the seller, having got his £1,000, may choose not to spend it immediately. And it is this gap between selling and buying which can cause a crisis. Marx put his view in Volume 1 of Capital, Chapter 3, it's the chapter on money or the circulation of commodities, and it's page 128 in the edition. He wrote, if the interval in time between the two complementary phases of the complete metamorphosis of a commodity becomes too great, if the split between the sale and the purchase becomes too pronounced, the intimate connection between them, their oneness, asserts itself by producing a crisis. Of course, he didn't mean that if this happens, if there's just one capitalist selling something and not buying something else. He was thinking of a situation in which, for the same kind of reason, a number of capitalists do this at the same time. It's interesting to notice, by the way, that Maynard Keynes also went into this business of the fallacy in J.B. Say's Law, but Keynes never appears to have known, and certainly never acknowledged the fact, that Marx had done it all 100 years before him. But now, we then have to ask, why is it that a number of manufacturers at the height of the boom suddenly curbed their investment and cut back production? And Marx gave his answer in Volume 3 of Capital, Chapter 30, it's page 568 in the Kerr edition. He first simplified the problem by saying, let's put aside financial crises and speculation, and let's assume for this purpose that capitalism consists entirely of industrial capitalists and wage workers. But he only did this just to simplify the statement of it. And he wrote this. He said, in that case, a crisis could be explained only by a disproportion of production in various branches and by a disproportion of the consumption of the capitalists and the accumulation of their capitals. But as matters stand, the reproduction of their capitals invested in production depends largely upon the consuming power of the non-producing classes, while the consuming power of labourers is handicapped partly by the laws of wages, partly by the fact that it can be exercised only so long as the labourers can be employed at a profit for the capitalist class. Now, you will notice that Marx refers to two kinds of disproportion. First, the disproportion of production in various branches. Second, the disproportion of the consumption of the capitalists and the accumulation of their capitals. The first one refers to the two main departments of production, the production of means of production, machinery, raw materials, factories, and so on, and the production of means of consumption, food and clothing, the necessary consumer goods and luxury goods bought by the working class and the capitalists. Now, these two departments obviously depend on each other. If the consumer goods industries stop buying machinery, raw materials and factories, the production goods industry industries are in trouble. And if the production goods industries can't sell their products, workers and capitalists in the production goods industries can't buy consumer goods. I mean, this is self-evident that they have to keep in some sort of harmony. There is, however, a significant difference between these two branches. In the consumer goods industries, the workers spend their wages buying consumer goods from the same body of capitalists, that's from the capitalists in the consumer industries. But in the producer goods industries, the capitalist can only get back the money he pays to his workers as wages indirectly. That is to say, by first selling production goods to fellow capitalists in another branch of production, either the consumer goods industries or the production goods industries. So the capitalist in the one case pays wages to his workers and the workers spend it in the consumer goods industries. In the other case, the capitalist pays wages to his workers and he can't get it back directly because the workers aren't going to spend it in the production goods industries, they're going to spend it in the consumer goods industries. Unless in this complicated way both branches keep in balance with each other, there is an upset which, if big enough, will cause a crisis. When you consider how production is actually planned, you will see that disproportion is absolutely inevitable. When each capitalist makes plans for future production, and he's got to do it in advance, I mean, you can't decide to produce more next Monday, you've got to make a plan somewhat ahead. When he does this, and makes plans for future production, he doesn't really know how big the market for his product is going to be. And even if he did know, he doesn't know what his rivals are doing in their plans. If he may try to guess at it, but he has no idea really what the other people are doing. And unforeseen events may make nonsense of all their plans, and they can't foresee this. I remember it was pointed out by a Shell oil company, who really, so to speak, ought to know all about oil, that they completely failed to see that at some stage the oil-producing countries would band together, put up a united front, and shove up the price of oil. Now, if there's anybody who ought to know, it was Shell, and they admitted they were taken completely by surprise by it. In practice, in every expansion and boom, disproportion does arise between the various branches of production. Take the years 1968 and 1973 in this country. 73 was the end of a boom period. The government here publishes separate production figures for what it describes as investment goods industries, consumer goods industries, and intermediate industries. And if you take 1968 as a base year, and then look at how much the production in these three groups had increased by 1973, you get this. The investment goods industries had gone up 11%, the consumer goods industries had gone up 25%, and the intermediate ones had gone up by 12%. And if you look at the last two years of that phase, from 1971 to 73, the increase for various industries were as follows. For the whole of the investment industries, they went up 5%, or the whole of the consumer industries went up 16%, and the motor car manufacturing only went up 2%. So here you can see this disproportion growing, and for quite obvious and necessary reasons. And, of course, it isn't as if the capitalists only have to worry about what's happening in this country. They've got to take a world view. I mean, look at steel production or shipbuilding or motor cars. They've got to try to guess what is happening in the rest of the world. It's quite obvious that in the late 60s and early 70s, the combined result of all the separate plans by all the capitalists all over the world was that there was a big overexpansion of iron and steel, shipbuilding, and motor cars.